The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, from the Harvard Health Letter, and also from the Harvard Heart Letter. And the first article is entitled Detecting Alzheimer's Disease, and it's from the December 2020 issue of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. Detecting Alzheimer's Disease, a complex diagnosis. Your memory just isn't what it used to be. Admittedly, it's far from it. But is it simply a part of getting older or a sign of something more? When you start to notice changes in your mental ability or your memory noticeably declines, it's best to have it evaluated. A diagnosis of dementia, which includes Alzheimer's disease, can't be made in a single step. Multiple tests are needed to identify the cause and severity of cognitive changes, but doing so gives you a better picture of what to expect and what can be done for care. Common tests and evaluations. During a basic dementia evaluation, a doctor will interview the person with possible dementia and someone who knows the person well about symptoms. The doctor will also take a medical history, conduct a physical exam that includes certain cognitive tests, and run basic lab tests. In addition, an important task is to identify or rule out other treatable causes of memory loss, like vitamin B12 deficiency, drug side effects, depression, or many other potential causes. Additional tests and assessments may be used to determine what cognitive changes may be occurring and how much these changes are affecting day-to-day life. An imaging test of the brain also is likely. Structural imaging shows the size, shape, and location of the different brain structures and is used most often to help determine the cause of dementia. The imaging tests doctors use for an overall assessment of dementia are magnetic resonance imaging and computerized tomography. These are called MRI and CT. MRI is the structural imaging test most preferred for cognitive concerns. With Alzheimer's disease, MRI may show shrinking or atrophy in the hippocampus, a part of the brain involved in memory. The doctor will then put all of this information together to make a diagnosis. In most cases, the information from this basic evaluation will tell a doctor if dementia is present and what's likely causing it. Functional and molecular imaging. Functional and molecular imaging tests are most commonly used in the research setting, but occasionally some of these tests are used in the clinic when a diagnosis isn't clear after a routine evaluation. Functional imaging using positron emission tomography, or PET scans, shows brain activity rather than brain structure. It detects changes in the chemical makeup of brain tissue, like how energy is processed or blood flows in the brain. The imaging helps link functions, like listening to a conversation or recalling a memory to different parts of the brain. Molecular imaging creates pictures that show and measure brain disease. It uses radioactive tracers that, when released into the brain, trigger chemical changes that are picked up in imaging. An amyloid PET scan and tau, that's T-A-U, PET scan have both been recently approved by the Food and Drug Administration. biomarker tests. A spinal fluid test may be used to measure levels of amyloid and tau around the brain and spinal cord. These proteins are biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease. Currently, the spinal fluid test of amyloid and tau is most commonly used to enroll participants in clinical trials, but is also occasionally used to confirm if Alzheimer's disease is causing cognitive impairment or contributing to it. A combination of low amyloid and a higher level of tau is the pattern a doctor looks for when diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's or a different dementia. Although different types of dementia have signs and symptoms in common, each type develops in its own way. Several signs and symptoms may point diagnosis toward Alzheimer's disease. These may include slow onset and gradual progression of symptoms, noticeable memory loss, normal neurologic function like strength, balance, reflex, and sensory skills, normal lab results, imaging testing showing signs of brain tissue loss in key brain regions like the hippocampus, which is important for memory. While no two people will experience dementia in the same way, identifying the type of dementia gives families and healthcare professionals additional information to tailor therapy and provide the best care and support. Now I'm going to turn to the Harvard Heart Letter, and we're going to read an article called "The Beat Goes On." Learn when, how, and why you should keep track of your heartbeat. Soon after you wake up tomorrow morning, before you even sit up in bed, take your pulse. It's fairly easy if you have a clock or timer nearby. Known as your resting heart rate, this value ranges from 60 to 100 in most adults. To get a good sense of your resting heart rate, check it every few mornings over the course of several weeks, advised cardiologist Dr. Aaron Bagish, director of the Cardiovascular Performance Program at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. It's best to measure your resting heart rate when you've been getting your typical amount of sleep and exercise and aren't feeling ill or dehydrated. Many factors can affect your heart rate, including age, fitness, and activity levels, emotions, body size, and medications. In general, a lower resting heart rate translates to better fitness and cardiovascular health. A resting heart rate that's too low, less than 50 beats per minute, or also one that's 100 or higher, could be a sign of trouble and should prompt a call to your doctor. Exercise to lower your heart rate. However, among elite endurance athletes, such as marathon runners and professional cyclists, a resting heart rate around 40 or even lower is normal. That's because exercise strengthens the heart, enabling it to pump a greater amount of blood with each beat. But even regular people who aren't hardcore athletes can lower their resting heart rates with exercise. If you go from sitting most of the day to exercising at least 30 minutes every day, your resting heart rate might eventually drop from 80 to 65. That's a measurable response that shows you've gotten more fit, says Dr. Bagish. Are target heart rates misleading? Some people like using smartwatches and fitness trackers to track their heart rate during exercise. These devices automatically calculate your target heart rate or the heart rate you're supposed to reach during exercise. But target heart rate zones aren't necessarily accurate for many people, says Dr. Bagish. Here's why. These devices calculate your target heart rate as a percentage of your maximum heart rate, which in turn is an estimate based solely on your age. A standard formula is 220 minus your age. Another is 200 minus half your age. These formulas were created based on measurements of people doing exercise stress tests. During these tests, people jog on a treadmill, while both the speed and incline of the treadmill gradually increases until they're too tired or out of breath. But there's a lot of intrinsic variability in how high a person's heart rate can go, says Dr. Bagish. The estimated maximum heart rate of a 70-year-old is 150. But that figure might be too low for a 70-year-old who is lean and runs 5 miles several times a week, and too high for a 70-year-old who is overweight and whose only exercise is a daily walk around the block. For this reason, most cardiologists recommend listening to your body and exercising based on your perceived effort instead of trying to reach an arbitrary number. During moderate intensity exercise, you should be breathing harder than usual, but still able to speak normally. During vigorous exercise, you should feel slightly breathless and able to utter only short phrases. Fancy gadgets may be inspiring for some people, but they can be misleading, and they're certainly not necessary, says Dr. Bagish. Heart rate recovery. If you're working on improving your cardiovascular fitness, one metric you might want to measure is your heart rate recovery. It's a gauge of how quickly your heart rate drops or recovers after intense exercise. To check it, simply measure your heart rate immediately after exercising, then again 2 minutes later. The difference between those two values is your heart rate recovery. A value of 20 is good, and higher is even better. A lower number suggests poor fitness. As with your resting heart rate, multiple measurements over time provide the most reliable information. If you're starting or ramping up an exercise routine, your resting heart rate may gradually drop, and your heart rate recovery value may slowly rise. Two trends that bode well for your heart and overall health. There's a subheading called Measuring Your Heart Rate. You can check your heart rate or pulse using just your fingers. With your index and middle fingers, press lightly on the opposite wrist, just below the fat pad of your thumb, or press gently on the side of your neck, just below your jawbone. Count the number of beats over a period of 30 seconds. Double that number to get your heart rate in beats per minute. Measuring for just 15 seconds and multiplying by 4 is also pretty accurate. Most, if not all, smartwatches and wrist-worn fitness trackers display your heart rate, thanks to optical sensors that detect light bouncing back from the blood flowing beneath the skin. If you have one of these devices, you can check its accuracy by comparing it to a self-administered pulse check, ideally at rest and during activities of different levels of intensity. There is also a subheading called Fruit of the Month. And the editors say, this year we're highlighting fruits on this page. Starting in February, we'll showcase a different type of fruit or group of related fruits like citrus fruits or melons. We'll include ideas about the best way to add more of these heart-healthy foods to your diet. If you eat berries with breakfast, snack on a banana, and toss some cubed apple or pear in your dinner salad, you can easily meet the recommended amount of fruit for adults, which is 1.5 to 2 cups per day. But such habits are unusual. Fewer than 1 in 10 Americans consumes the minimum recommended amount of fruit, according to a national federal survey. The latest data from the CDC show that about 35% of adults typically have less than one serving of fruit per day, and that figure includes 100% fruit juice, which isn't nearly as healthy as eating whole fruit. Fruit juice contains very little fiber, a nutrient known to help lower cardiovascular risk. What's more, a serving of fruit juice is much higher in sugar and calories than whole fruit. For example, a cup of orange juice has 21 grams of sugar and 113 calories, whereas a medium orange has just 12 grams of sugar and 65 calories. Now we're going to go to the Ask the Doctor section of Harvard Heart Letter. This is by Dr. Deepak Bhatt, MD, MPH, who is the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. The first question is, what is a myocardial bridge? My 64-year-old brother had some transient chest pain while he was training for a cycling trip, so I urged him to see his doctor. Tests show that he has a myocardial bridge. What does that mean? The arteries that supply blood to the heart lie on the surface of the organ, but in some people, one of these arteries dives into the heart muscles and comes back out again, forming what is called a myocardial bridge. The bridge refers to the band of heart muscle that extends over that portion of the artery. This anatomical variation, present from birth, is usually harmless. But the prevalence is really pretty much unknown. Myocardial bridges are discovered in fewer than 5% of people who undergo angiography, a procedure that uses a special dye and x-rays to reveal how blood flows through the heart. But in studies of people who undergo more elaborate heart imaging tests, the average prevalence is 25%. And in one autopsy study, half the cases showed a myocardial bridge. Most myocardial bridges are found in the heart's largest artery, the left anterior descending artery. Most people with this condition never have any symptoms. However, the segment of blood vessel that's covered by the contracting heart muscle might get squeezed. Occasionally, as could potentially be the case with your brother, this reduces blood flow to the heart muscle, especially during exercise when the heart is working harder than usual. This can lead to temporary chest pain or discomfort, called angina. Less often, people experience more intense symptoms that are similar to those of a heart attack. When that happens, doctors usually prescribe medications like beta blockers, which may help by slowing down the heart and making it contract less forcefully. Calcium channel blockers, another class of medications, also may be useful, as they can prevent artery spasm, which can be another unusual cause of chest pain. People with angina caused by artery clogging plaque, a much more common cause of angina, sometimes take drugs like nitroglycerin, which widens the heart's arteries. But for people with myocardial bridge, nitrates can make their symptoms worse because they can further compress the tunneled artery. For the very small subset of people with debilitating symptoms that aren't relieved by medication, surgery is an option. The procedure known as surgical unroofing cuts through the heart muscle to uncover the tunneled artery. This relieves the compression on the artery and alleviates the symptoms, though it's extremely unusual to need to take this step. Next is an interesting article called Gut Check, How the Microbiome May Mediate Heart Health, And again, this is from the January 2021 Harvard Heart Letter. Your cholesterol and other factors linked to cardiovascular health may be influenced by the bacteria in your belly. The roughly 38 trillion bacteria that dwell deep within your intestines perform many important tasks. Collectively known as the gut microbiota, these microbes help digest food, metabolize medications, and protect you from infectious organisms. In many ways, your gut microbiota, which weighs about half a pound in total, functions somewhat like a distinct organ in your body. Just as you have a unique genome, you also have a unique gut microbiome, consisting of 8 million genes that control your microbiota. Sciences are still learning how the composition and diversity of the gut microbiome influences the health of the cardiovascular system. One recent discovery involves a group of gut bacteria that can break down cholesterol in the intestines. Since the early 1900s, scientists have known that gut bacteria could transform cholesterol into a compound called coprostenol, but they didn't know which species were doing it. So researchers analyzed stool samples from 3,079 people to characterize their gut microbiomes and then sequenced nearly 6 million microbial genes. They found that people with a gene they dubbed ISMA in their microbiome excreted up to 75% less cholesterol in their feces than people who didn't carry that bacterial gene. The presence of this gene was also linked with lower blood cholesterol levels in the participants. The findings, published last year in the journal Cell Host and Microbe, could help explain why some people can consume more cholesterol in their diets with relatively little effect on their blood cholesterol levels. The findings lend more support to the concept that modifying the microbiome could have a therapeutic effect, says study co-author Dr. Stanley Shaw, a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital and associate dean for executive education at Harvard Medical School. But a microbiome-based therapy for heart disease is still years away, he cautions. In theory, it could help to directly introduce the cholesterol-metabolizing enzymes into the gut, or to boost populations of those cholesterol-lowering bacteria through diet, probiotics, or another method. By the way, probiotics are beneficial bacteria found in certain foods, like yogurt, as well as over-the-counter supplements. But figuring out the best approach is still quite mysterious, since we can't reliably predict if the newly introduced bacteria actually colonize the gut, Dr. Shaw notes. The microbiome appears to influence additional factors associated with heart health, including body weight, blood pressure, diabetes, and inflammation. For example, people who are naturally thin have a different gut microbiota than people who are overweight, possibly because certain bacteria extract more calories from some foods than other bacteria. Likewise, people with a high blood pressure seem to have less diverse microbiota, that is, fewer species, than people with a normal blood pressure. But the problem with these observations is the old chicken or egg conundrum. Are differences in the microbiota causing the health problem, or are they instead a reaction or compensation by the body in response to the problem, says Dr. Shaw. What's intriguing about the microbiome is that it seems to serve as intermediary for some of the lifestyle factors that have a favorable effect on cardiovascular health, says Dr. Shaw. Take dietary fiber. Fiber-rich diets appear to lower the risk of heart disease and stroke by as much as 30%. Some of this benefit may arise from fiber's ability to help eliminate cholesterol from the body, but other factors may be at work. In your gut, fiber gets broken down by bacteria in your colon to form short-chain fatty acids. These compounds interact with specific receptors on cells that regulate blood pressure, affect hormones involved in diabetes, and dampen inflammation, all of which influence cardiovascular health. The take-home message. For now, there's no specific heart-related advice related to the gut microbiome. However, plant-based diets, which are good for heart disease, appear to foster a more diverse and healthier gut microbiome. Stay tuned for future advances from the complex but exciting area of microbiome research and therapeutics, says Dr. Shaw. Here's a brief research we're watching called Taking Steps to Avoid High Blood Pressure. Walking even at a casual pace, covering a mile in 30 minutes 5 days a week, may lower the odds of high blood pressure in postmenopausal women, a new study finds. Researchers relied on data from more than 83,000 women, 50 to 79, who did not have high blood pressure. When they joined the study, they filled out questionnaires about their walking speed and duration. This was followed by yearly questionnaires that included checking for a diagnosis of high blood pressure. After an average follow-up of 11 years, women who walked at a pace of at least 2 miles per hour for 2.5 hours per week had a reduced risk of being diagnosed with high blood pressure. Those who walked at a faster speed also had a lower risk. Like other forms of physical activity, walking triggers many changes that likely contribute to lower blood pressure, including reducing levels of stress hormones and enhancing blood vessel health. Well, it looks like we run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Yunkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I hope you enjoyed it.